When you look at a patient's history in terms of therapy-related AML, are you mainly looking for anthracyclines or any other sort of agents or regimens that kind of raise your level of suspicion?
There's three modalities that really increase the risk of leukemia following prior therapy for other cancers. And the agents that we worry about in this setting are anthracyclines or topoisomerase II poisons. So that includes etoposide. So we'll see the higher rate in patients who've been cured of, say, testicular cancer and women who've had prior breast cancer therapy. But recognizing also those women get radiation, and radiation can also work as a TOPO2 inhibitor, or it can work like an alkylator in terms of inducing the kinds of damage that we see in alkylator-based leukemias. Alkylator-based leukemias usually present with MDS and sometimes with AML, and there can be a very long latency between the exposure and the leukemia. So in somebody who presented 10 years after breast cancer therapy, I'm much more worried about the alkylator and/or the radiation causing an alkylator-type injury, which often leads to p53 mutation and complex karyotype, again, monosomal karyotype, and very poor outcomes, both with induction and also post-remission therapy. Really, those patients need to get transplanted if you can get them to transplant. Low CR rates to induction. What we see with TOPO2 poisons, however, is it looks like a de novo leukemia, and it may happen only months to a year or two after the exposure. So that short latency is what leads me to say it's more likely related to those agents. So if someone had breast cancer therapy and 6 months later they have a leukemia, we look for the translocations there or a normal karyotype. They're more likely to have intermediate or favorable risk genetics, but we sometimes see translocations of the MLL gene in chromosome 11q23, and those can be much higher risk. So those patients will often err on the side of transplant.
So another question that this case raises, and a lot of cases raise, is intensive versus non-intensive. And this comes up a lot in oncology, you know, mantle cell, whatever. You know, of course, everybody says age is not a number, but then you start asking about 90, 95-year-olds and people kind of back off. But generally speaking, for example, how did you evaluate this woman? How did she look? What was her performance status?
Fitness is a strong predictor of doing well with chemotherapy. And it's variable because, you know, we'll see patients who've had prior therapy for lymphoma and have had an autologous transplant and then develop leukemia. And it doesn't take a lot of chemotherapy to tip those patients over. So one nice thing about giving induction to those patients is you can see, can I transplant this patient or not? You're not going to get that sense from a low-intensity approach. And you don't want to find out during transplant that the patient really can't tolerate chemotherapy. So for that reason alone, it's sometimes worthwhile to think about, is this somebody I can offer induction to? And again, in a therapy-related leukemia, we err on the side of giving CPX when it's an appropriate choice for the reasons I mentioned before. But low-intensity therapy is something that many patients want just because they've had prior chemotherapy and they know it's hard. And they may not have in their mind, okay, I need to get transplanted. They may not have expected to survive their prior cancer as long as they did. And it was a blessing that they got this far. When they get AML or MDS, they just say, okay, enough. I don't want to be in the hospital. I don't want to be getting this therapy. I don't want to be going through all the toxicity if there's not a very high likelihood of payoff. And you have to have a really informed conversation with your patient about this. So yes, if the patient bounces back to excellent baseline of health, is doing well, has great functionality, and really is, again, swinging for the fences and looking for the best treatment outcome for the longest amount of time, we treat them aggressively. We go for transplant. It's the only way to cure that disease with rare exceptions. And that's how you have to look at these patients. That's how I looked at this patient. The only complicating issue was the amount of prior anthracycline. And again, we don't have an exact number. Once you start adding up the numbers and you get up to around 500 milligrams per meter squared of daunorubicin equivalents, then you kind of are at the range where you have to worry about, are you going to push the heart into permanent failure, where you couldn't do a transplant necessarily if the patient winds up with bad cardiomyopathy. So it can be challenging.